I'll see you in September, when summer is gone. Have a good time, but remember, I'll be waiting back home.
Hello and welcome to episode 2.21, the June 28th, 2023, and final season 2, See You in September edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. Summer is now upon us in every way, and as events at the Opera House wind down, we'll be taking a summer break from producing this podcast. But before we begin our summer relaxation, I would like to mention that summer in Chautauqua County is anything but boring. There are so many free events going on across the county that there's always something to do or see. Not only that, but recreational opportunities abound as well. In a way, the summer is so beautiful in this part of New York State and, indeed, the country, that being indoors seems almost ridiculous. What could the Opera House possibly present during the summer that can compete with free festivals and music at Dunkirk Pier, events at Chautauqua Institute, the Chautauqua County Fair, the Great Blue Heron Festival, the Lilydale Assembly, regional farmers markets, the Lake Erie Shoreline, all the great wineries, Tarp Skunks Baseball, and so many other events. As wonderful as the arts programming is at the Opera House, it's hard to compete with the bounty of activity available to us all in this county. So it is that I urge you to check out all that the county offers over the summer by heading to the Chautauqua County Visitors Bureau website at tourchautauqua.com and see for yourself all that the county has to offer over the summer. Nonetheless, the Opera House still has a few events up its sleeve that I am sure will be of interest to our listeners and any visitors to the county. The Opera House itself is a great attraction, with its beautifully restored interior and its rich cultural history. So let's get a preview of three of the events coming up this summer.
And now, here he is, the star of our show, Red Skelton.
Thank you very much, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First, I'd like to thank Walter Winchell for the nice thing he said in his column, and I'd like to thank Dinah Shore for using one of my paintings on her show. It's really been hot out here in California, you folks that are coming out. We went swimming on Sunday, and my wife wore one of those new sack swimming suits, you know? I got arrested for saining without a license. They had a sportsman show out here, and they had a fellow that climbs up a 150-foot ladder, and he dives into this small little tank like that. So they asked, anybody in the audience want to do it? So they all looked at me, and I, you know, big show-off. I climb up this 150-foot ladder, and I took one. You know, it's harder to climb down a ladder than it is to climb up. And then we now have Major League Baseball out here at last. And the way the Dodgers are playing, that's the way they're going to wind up. I went out there, there was 78,000 people watching the game and 10,000 saw it. This place is so big, this Coliseum, I'll tell you, it's so big that they've got restroom on the way to the restroom.
Like many of my generation, Red Skelton was the second most favorite variety TV show growing up, coming in after Ed Sullivan, of course. Over a career that spanned 70 years, including vaudeville, burlesque, medicine shows, radio, movies, television, and live performances, Red Skelton brought joy and laughter wherever he performed. After years denying that he resembled Red Skelton, Brian Hoffman finally gave in and developed a tribute show entitled Remembering Red, a tribute to Red Skelton. He will be bringing his show to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Friday, July 14th at 7:30 p.m. and I got the chance to talk with him about how he came to create this tribute performance. Well, I have a hint for all you listeners. This is probably going to be rather a humorous interview because I have with me Mr. Brian Hoffman, and Brian is a Red Skelton impersonator, and I think that's not a fair description of him, because when I look at him, and I know you can't see him, but if you come to the show, you'll be able to see him for sure, that he's the spitting image of Red Skelton. It's kind of scary. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. No problem. No problem. Yep. So let's start off talking about Red Skelton by trying to figure out, first of all, how you decided to take on this character. Now you look very much like him. I must say, your hair is red, your smile, your eyes, everything about you really just kind of screams the character. But there's the fingers. Thank you.
Now they're going to wonder what you meant by that.
Well, those are the Klunkadiddlehopper fingers, some people will know what that is. So how did you get into this?
Boy, that's a great question, and it took many, many years of denial before I finally accepted it. I was, for the most, afraid to take on that challenge. You know, I was going to be impersonating one of the biggest icons, comedic icons there was. You know, he was a mainstay in everybody's home for 20 years. We would all sit around the television and watch every little move and thing that he did. And for me to try to be that guy was a little scary at first, to say the least. But I had started my own comedy routine, per se. You know, I was a little more blue than Red was, not real bad, but a little bit. And then the old people would come up to me afterwards telling me how much I reminded them of Red Skelton. And I would politely deny it. And then I went to Las Vegas. I through a series of losing jobs and different things that happened in my life, I ran away to Las Vegas, and I said I was going to get my own show. And my wife said, "You're nuts." So I guess it's official. I'm nuts, because I did accomplish it. I didn't go there with the intent of becoming Red Skelton. I thought I could make it on my own. But as I was doing my shtick, I ran into a lot of impersonators, mainly Elvises, out there in Vegas. And they kind of, the one in particular was a voice impressionist, took me in under his wing and showed me the ropes and gave me a shot. And from that point on, I've been doing Red Skelton.
And have you developed this routine like by yourself, or have you had help? Have you had advisors? Do other people who have, you know of Red Skelton sort of give you feedback or anything like that? Or is this really you?
It's really me, I guess. I have had some feedback. But for the most part, and especially when I first started, it seemed difficult because I couldn't find material. It was like it wasn't out there. And then I stumbled into a VHS tape at a library, and I went, "Oh, I got to watch this." So, and then I would literally watch it, stop it, rewind it, watch it, stop it, rewind it, and then write down verbatim everything that he did and said, to try to emulate him to the best of my ability. And it was very difficult at first. I guess I thought I needed to act like somebody else to act like Red Skelton. but the more I acted like me, the more I said, "Wow, you're just like Red Skelton." So that was a hard thing to accomplish at first, but eventually paid off. And now, as years have gone by, we get more and more of these videos out there. Plus, now with the blessings of the Red Skelton Estate and the museum, I have access to all the archives of his old kinescopes and the shows and whatnot. So I have a lot of help now.
And we should really point out, just in case anybody's interested, that the Red Skelton Estate really has approved all of your work, all of the routines and everything like that, because a lot of that material, in my research, I read that at one point Red Skelton said that when he died, he wanted everything to be burned, all of his scripts, all of that. So, but that didn't happen, thank God.
No,
so
no, Thankfully, Red's Widow did not follow that wish, and it's still available, and you can see a lot of it at the museum. And once in a while, if you're a member of the museum, you get insides, you get the videos that nobody else gets to see. So,
Red Skelton, as a TV movie personality, had an incredibly long career. I am of the generation that, between him and Ed Sullivan, were probably the two television shows you would watch. I remember my father watching, so on and so forth. And his career spanned that whole development from early vaudeville all the way to variety TV. I think his show was finally canceled in 1970. And even
71.
71. Okay. Yeah, and even then he got into HBO. What does that kind of tell you about his staying power in terms of the world of entertainment and the taste of the American public?
Yeah, he captured the essence of everybody. It didn't matter if what neighborhood you lived in. He could get that emotion out, and everybody loved him. I've never run into anybody that said, "Oh, I hated that man." Mm-hmm. You know, and there are a lot of celebrities out there that if you talk to somebody about that, they go, "Oh, I didn't like anything he did." You know, and I've never ran into that with Red Skelton, which is amazing that he could capture the hearts of so many individuals, regardless of what their background was from, regardless of what their heartache was. And again, like you said, he started way back. We're actually in the 100th anniversary of him when he took to the stage at the age of 10 back in 1923.
Wow.
That's incredible.
It just doesn't seem that long when you think about it, but all of a sudden you go, 100 years, man, that is really something. That is really something.
And he would do these little medicine shows, traveling medicine shows during the summer, go to school in the winter. And then by the age of 15 or 16, I believe, is when he finally dropped out of school and started performing full time on the road.
He was obviously he became very famous with his Donut Dunkers routine, which was probably the thing that sprung him out. Do you do that one?
It really did. You know, I've thought about it, and then I look at my waistline and I go, no, I don't think I should, because he was doing that during the Depression.
Yes,
you
he
gotta
was.
Realize, yeah, when he was 16, the Depression hit, and that's kind of hard to fathom. Yeah, he was born in 1913, so when he was in 1929, he was 16, doing the Dunkin', and I think he might have been just a little bit older when he started doing the Dunkin' Donut routine. Edna Stillwell was his first wife. Mm-hmm. And between them two, they observed this and got that routine written down. And so during the time when most people were starving, Red Skelton was gaining weight, eating all these donuts, because he'd be doing like two or three shows a day back in the vaudeville days and have to do that routine. Plus having all those donuts on hand. I did hear one cute story that he had a dog eat all of his donuts right before showtime. And so now they were scrambling to try to find donuts so he could do his bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't do that, but it is a very cute routine.
So many of his characters that he created, Freddy the Freeloader, Clem Cadiddlehopper, the Mean Widow Kid. I mean, they all, I think, have a heart to them that is... you can almost follow a through line on the characters. You know, it's not that they're the same, but the genuine sort of humanity that comes through all of them is really kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It is, and deep down inside, they're all Red Skelton wearing a different hat. You know, but Junior, these folks that come to see the show up there will be seeing Junior, the Mean Widow Kid.
Oh, good. Okay.
You're
going to dude it.
I dude it. I dude it. I had a cute little outfit. I dude it. And mommy said to me, Junior, are you pulling that cat's tail? I said, no, mommy, I holding it. The cat's doing the pulling.
There you go.
Yeah, I started that out in Las Vegas, but nobody was getting it. So I thought, well, I'll put that on the back burner for now. And as soon as I moved to Pigeon Forge, the first thing people were saying to me, do you do Junior? I'm like, what? So I worked on it and got that into the routine. It took me, I probably listened to 120 Red Skelton radio shows to create the routine that I did for Junior. It was taking a little line out of this episode because it couldn't, the way he would interact with mom and grandma and the other people in the show, it's kind of hard to turn that into a one-man monologue. So I would grab a line here and there. Yeah.
You know, one of the things I found interesting about his career was that he had a Hollywood career for a while, and he played a lot of, you know, supporting characters, side characters, comic relief, so on and so forth. But he never really seemed to take to the movies. He ultimately really was more interested in being on radio and ultimately television. I couldn't figure out why. Do you have any insight on that?
I don't, but you do realize he was in 50 movies.
And it doesn't seem that way when you think about his career, you know?
Yeah. The one where he was the main person was, it was called The Clown, and he plays a dramatic role. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
I never had, no.
Yeah, that's one I highly recommend watching. It's almost kind of like his life. He did it in 1953, which was, I believe, about the same time that he found out his son had leukemia. Mm-hmm. And he played a good dramatic role. Tim Considine played his son.
Oh.
That name ring a bell?
Yes, it does. Tim Considine. Although I can't, I can't place a specific thing, but the name does indeed ring a bell.
It does, because he was Mikey, Mike on My Three Sons.
Ah, there it is. Okay.
Yep. People don't, they're like, that sounds familiar. And that's why, because we all watch My Three Sons.
Yeah. You know, correct.
Yeah. Yeah. He was the oldest.
Yeah. He liked to call himself, he didn't like to call himself a comedian or anything like that. The only thing he really wanted to be called was a clown.
Yeah.
And I found that fascinating.
Yeah, because a clown can relate to everybody, happy or sad, doesn't matter. So, yeah, he really preferred being looked at as a clown that can make somebody happy, somebody smile, bring out good emotions in everybody.
And he always thought that a clown was a kind of a character or a thing that can do anything. Clowns can sing, clowns can dance, clowns can, you know, and he did all of that.
He did.
Know?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
An incredible dancer. Most people didn't know it.
Right. Yeah. As far as his, he was great friends with, apparently with Marcel.
Yeah.
The mime. And when you watch him do his work, his physical work, like if you take, for example, I think it's the Guzzler's Gin routine where, you know, he slowly gets more drunk as he has to drink this gin for a television sponsor. The physicality that he's able to pull off is astounding. Do you when you work that into your routine? How much rehearsal or practice did you have to get to be anywhere near what he seems to be able to do with so much ease?
Yeah, see, that's the tough part, and I don't know how to explain it, but I sit and I watch and look at it and watch it and listen and try to observe those little teeny tiny things. And do my best to recreate that image that from what you remember. I can pull off that drunk look pretty good.
why couldn't I get an oatmeal program?
So but people love the Guzzler's Gin and it's a lot of fun to do it. In everything that I do, I guess there's a little bit of me that comes through. But again, most people, when they're seeing it, it reminds them so much of Red Skelton. Mm-hmm. And if you'd have told me when I was sitting on my dad's lap at 10 years old watching the Red Skelton show, pay attention, this is what you're going to be doing. Yeah, I'd have been like, you're nuts.
Yes.
You are nuts.
Now, as far as your own career has gone, you've gone so far as to, in fact, build a Red Skelton tribute theater.
Yeah.
And you do this show there quite constantly, and you travel an awful lot. I mean, this really keeps you busy. What motivated you to build the theater as a place to do this?
This is funny. This is funny because in July of 2014, I played the Fredonia Opera House.
Wow, really?
I did. And then I had a gig down. Then I flew from Fredonia and I had a gig down in Florida and I did that one. And when I got done doing that one, I still had a couple, 3 days before I had to get back to Las Vegas. So I rented a car and I drove up to Pigeon Forge and I checked out the town and I went, I think this is going to work. So I eventually found a theater that would give me a shot. And I came back for a month just to test the market. I got received very well. Mm-hmm. Everybody was very supportive here, which is what I was really thrown aback at because that didn't happen in Las Vegas. It was pretty cutthroat. So, mm-hmm. But here everybody was willing to help out, give advice. And I was like, this should work.
Well, yeah. Brian, I have got to believe that your show is going to be absolutely worthwhile to those of us who are of a certain age, because, yes. You know, the looking at that and then reminiscing about our own childhood, like you say, yep. Watching the show for years. That's going to be, a very, interesting and fun evening in the theater. So we look forward to having you back at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, in July, and, safe travels and good luck until then.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Remembering Red, a tribute to Red Skelton, will be performed on Friday, July 14th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $18 for Opera House members, and $10 for students. Tickets can be purchased online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891. The next two offerings at the Opera House are from the Stage on Screen series, which is generously sponsored by Dr. James and Marcia Merrins. They are both from the National Theatre in London, a production of Shakespeare's Othello, which will be screened on Saturday, July 8th at 1 p.m., as well as Good, a play by C.P. Taylor, starring David Tennant of Doctor Who fame, screening on Saturday, July 29th at 1 p.m. For this series of shows, I decided to try and get the heaviest hitter I could think of in the region in terms of theatrical criticism and expertise, and I managed to score this two-part interview with Dr. Anthony Chase, who in the Buffalo theater community is simply known as Tony Chase. Tony has been a fixture in the Buffalo theater community for close to 35 years, and he brings his unique brand of passion and wit to this two-part discussion of Othello and Good.
Oh, my fair warrior!
My dear Othello!
It gives me wonder, great as my content, to see thee here before me. Were I now to die, 'twere now to be most happy. For I fear my soul hath her content so absolute that not another comfort like to this succeeds in unknown fate.
The heavens forbid, but that our loves and comfort should increase even as our days do grow.
Amen, sweet powers. I cannot speak enough of this content. It stops me here. It is too much of joy. And this, the greatest discords be that ever our hearts shall make.
First, Shakespeare's Othello. This production's director, Clint Dyer, the first black man to produce a production of Othello at the National, brings a unique perspective to this production, highlighting themes of racism and misogyny within the context of a story of love, jealousy, and passion. Tony and I discuss all these elements in this interview. Well, I cannot emphasize enough to my listening audience how wonderful it is to have my next guest here. He is Dr. Anthony Chase. He is an assistant dean at Buffalo State College, but much more than that. He's also known as Tony Chase. He is a theater critic for the Buffalo News. He also wrote for Art Voice. He is one of the co-hosts of Theater Talk in Buffalo, and I can't think of a single person who has done more to promote and build theater in the city of Buffalo. He's also the inspiration and creator of the Artie Awards. So, Tony, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you.
Well, wow. Thank you. I'm proud to be here with you, Professor Laughlin.
Thank you. So you, of course, are someone who I consider to be incredibly knowledgeable in the world of the theater. You travel all over the United States to see theater, Broadway. You've gone to London. You've been to the National for our the shows that are coming up. Not that you've seen them, but you've been to the National Theater as I have. And I think maybe I'd like to start with that, like just to give us your impression of what the National Theater is, what it does, an overview of it, and what it means to British theater and British culture.
Well, the theater across Britain is more central to the lives of people than we might be accustomed to in the United States. Maybe Western New Yorkers aside, it's sort of a national entitlement to have theater available to you if you're in Britain. And there's a great deal more public subsidy for the theater in Britain than here. They cannot approach us for the commercial theater of Broadway, you know, the billion-dollar industry of Broadway, and we export a lot of product there. But in London, in the early 60s, that whole post-war boost toward the celebration of Western civilization and democracy, Laurence Olivier and a bunch of his friends founded a royal national theater. Now they've dropped the Royal of Great Britain, which introduces new plays, which revisits classics, which is widely accessible to people in and coming to London. And the program, the specific program that we're focusing on, where are these broadcasts of plays done at the National, was begun about 20 years ago to reach a wider audience with these very high quality productions. And what more to say about it? It's three theaters in the complex. I think it's three. Did they have, last time I was there? There were three, and
I see. I think there still are three. Yeah.
Yeah,
three.
And right on the river. It's gorgeous, and it is one of the great. That cultural institution is one of the great points of pride for Britain, and they can do most anything there. That I think that the show that I was most aware of at the National. Well, a couple. I did research for a show at the National when they did James Baldwin's The Amen Corner, which takes place in a storefront church, an African-American storefront church. They don't have its equivalent in Britain. And though the play takes place in New York City, those churches don't exist in New York City. So Ian McNeil, who was the designer, contacted me, understanding that these still do exist in Buffalo, New York, which they did. And so I worked with Lorna C. Hill of Ujima Theater Company, a last departed. And Ian McNeil came to Buffalo and we ran around town visiting and photographing storefront churches, and also looking at the collection of the storefront churches that the photographer Milton Rogovin of Buffalo had done back in the 50s, which are in the collection at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center. So that was my closest connection. And then when Ian designed Inspector Coles, J.B. Priestley's Inspector Coles, which was one of, I think to this day, the most successful play ever launched from the National, I was able to see it there twice and to get a view of it backstage and get quite a look at the National. And it is an extraordinary facility.
Yes, if anybody ever has the chance to go, I really highly recommend it. Now, we're talking about the two plays we're talking about are Shakespeare's Othello, which is coming July 8th at 1 p.m. That's a Saturday. And then again, a play called Good. But I want to start off with the Othello. Let's talk about that. As far as Othello goes, it is probably the thing about these two particular plays is that they are, I think they have very current messages for audiences today. Othello is a play that has a lot going for it. And when you look at that play, Tony, what do you pull from it the most?
I think that any play that you look at, you're looking at it from the lens of your current moment. You're not looking at it as an artifact from archaeology of some kind. I just looked at a BBC version of Joe Orton's What the Butler Saw and had forgotten how much of that play is about gender fluidity, about do the clothes make your gender, and seeing it in a different, completely different way from the way I had remembered it from college, you know, mm-hmm. which is now many years ago. But always for Othello, that the person you trust might have an agenda of their own, that we all have vulnerabilities and frailties, and the people who know us best are the best equipped to exploit them, which is what happens in this play. And it is even the vulnerability of the relationship between Othello and Desdemona that Othello is told at a number of points not to trust her, and that, you know, beginning with her father, if she would betray me, she could betray you. He plants that seed. And then some just general things that we easily lapse into generalizations about people. They do this about Othello's race, that he must have gotten her by witchcraft. They do it about every woman in this play is called a whore, mm-hmm. every single one. And yet none of them sees herself in that way. It is the perception the world has of us, the perceptions we have of ourselves. And that really is what I focus on when seeing Othello, which it's a play I've revisited often and that which I like in particular. And I think the genius of Shakespeare is in those subtleties of human frailty, that he is able to recognize and then examine, pushing further and further and further.
I think you've hit the nail on the head in the sense, because I know that the director of this particular play is his name is Clint Dyer, and he's the first black man to direct this play at the National. And also he's a deputy artistic director at the National now too. And he did an interview with the New York Times, and he talked about how when he first came to the National to see a play, he remembered that they had posters up there. And the first one of the first posters he happened to see was the 1964 production of Othello with Laurence Olivier in blackface.
Oh, dear. With Maggie Smith as Desdemona in that production, replaced by Billy Whitelaw.
Yes.
Interestingly.
Yes.
But yeah, they used to do that. Yeah, and no one thought a thing about it.
Yes, and no one thought a thing about it. And now he has a chance to do his own production of it. And he said it's a kind of an interesting full circle for him to be able as a black man to do this play and not bring his own sensibilities to it. And two of the themes that he did touch upon, which you just did, was racism and the misogyny that's inherent in the play. There's a point in the play where apparently Othello takes his shirt off and we see lacerations from whips to imply that he has escaped from slavery. We see Emilia, who is Iago's wife. She comes on stage with a black eye and an arm in like a sling or a bandage to indicate, of course, that she's been beaten. And apparently he has taken these two themes and really, you know, sort of pushed them, you know, out front in his production. And he's got a lot of credit for it in reviews for it being a powerful production in that regard.
Yeah, you take it sounds like a bit of auteurism, you know, in the French sense of auteur, that for Amelia, the way that her husband treats her seems to be, you know, a close step to perhaps he hits her. I don't recall a textual reference to that or to the treatment that is being imposed historically on the Othello character. I don't, interesting choice, interesting directorial choice. Dramaturgically, I would like to see the textual support for these interpretations, but I see the direction in which we're going.
Yes, well, I think that that's, you know, one of the things that you and I kind of agree upon is you look for those textual references to support whatever it is you put on the stage. And I think this is one where he has taken the liberties of that. The Amelia is played by Tanya Franks, and they say that she really steals the show in her scenes in Act 4 with when she talks about If Wives Do Fall speech and things like that, that she has some really powerful moments.
Well, that character is much more wonderful than is typically remembered. That and is central to everything that happens in the plot. It's that her duty to her husband, even at certain points, her trust, but also her mistrust of her husband, both things happening at once, that is a central and important character. And a character who comes to have regrets that she is used, and realizes the folly of what she has, of how she has allowed herself to be used, arguably. Mm-hmm. That'll be exciting to see. Someone who's highly praised for that role, a role that many people forget even exists as they retell the plot of Othello.
Right, exactly. And I find it a fascinating role. Interestingly enough, though, none of the notices that I saw for this particular production of Othello have a lot to say about the Iago. And I wonder, I had exactly the same reaction. It's like, oh, wow. And I can't help but wonder if Clint Dyer did something with the Iago to de-emphasize his importance in the play, to bring in other themes that he wanted to push more to the forefront.
We'll find out.
Yes, we will find out. I found that sort of... The only contrast I saw was someone made a comparison to Mark Rylance's creation of Iago at the National a number of years ago, and it wasn't the best, and I wonder if the play's going to suffer because of that. I mean, Iago's such a critical character to me, the way in which he just sucks Othello into his net.
Yeah, that's central to the whole thing. The evil he pours into his ear, and which he trustingly believes, that we have this in common too with the next play we're going to talk about. Good is that, as Shakespeare repeatedly shows us, all people are flawed, and all people have weaknesses. And the history of this play, the various times in which it's been seen, that throughout the 19th century, throughout the 18th century, even sort of a cautionary tale to, don't stray outside the clan, don't marry outside your own. These people are temperamental and influenceable, which does not seem to us to be what the play is about at all. Mm. That we see him, everything manipulated and abused by Iago, who has an agenda and who recognizes the desires of other people and how to twist and exploit them, which he does.
This particular production stars Giles Terrera as Othello and Rosie McEwen as Desdemona. And it's interesting that one of the things that I noticed, again, in doing my research on this particular production, is that... Rosie McEwen does not play Desdemona as a fragile 19-year-old. She plays her as a bit of a stronger character, and Giles Terrera is a little bit more aloof. They claim to be in love with each other, but there's no apparent chemistry between the two of them, as it were. And I wonder if that's deliberate.
I think that you'll know this from the perspective of acting that. There are always the broadest strokes on the page, that there are characters we seem to know as well as we know the actual people in our lives, but we're only going to be with them for 2 to 3 hours, that it's always in the broadest of strokes. And in reading plays, we read Shakespeare a lot, and students write about it, scholars write about it, but it's only when actors embody these people that they come fully to life for us, or create the illusion of having come fully to life. And you can give witness to the fact that this requires unnumberable choices as to how to play something, because something else, unlike a novel, and although Shakespeare writes in a sophisticated poetic style, is a master of words and of puns and of just manipulation of language, it is of necessity very simple. The telling of the story has to be simple because the audience only hears it in a single gesture. Mm-hmm. And so this leaves the actor responsible to decide everything. You know, how do I say this? How do I react to that? And so there's colossal latitude. So as we're just talking about, how will Iago be played? Well, we may be disappointed if we have always seen Iago as dominating everything. But what if he doesn't? What if we instead focus on the people who are manipulated by him? And he becomes almost minor, as by the end of the play he is. Once he is exposed, it is, how did this silly little man cause so much damage?
Right.
He just seems so insignificant by the end of the play. Once the truth is exposed, he's a nobody. Mm-hmm. How could these substantial people have allowed this to happen? And that's one of the pleasures of seeing multiple productions of the same play. And in our world, Shakespeare most often affords this opportunity that we get to see more of Shakespeare than any other writer still today. And we will obsess about those kinds of things, which are great, great fun. I'm waiting for the Measure for Measure, which I, you know, by the time this plays will have opened at Shakespeare in Delaware Park. And that play is famous for how to play Isabel's reactions. Because at the pivotal moment, what does Shakespeare give her to say? Nothing.
That's right. Nothing.
He gives her nothing. And so that leaves it to the actor playing the role to decide, you know, how is she responding to this? So Othello, yes, potent with that kind of opportunity. The facts of the story are the facts of the story, but the texture is up to the artists who are doing it, as you say, right now, for an audience that's living right now. And there we go.
And that's what keeps me coming back to Shakespeare and keeps me coming back to the theater, because you never see the same show twice, ever.
No, when the Folger Group came, UB brought the Folger Group to do the residency this past spring. I went to a couple of the sessions down at the library, because it was also in conjunction with the Buffalo and Erie County Public Library. There was a panel of representatives of every local theater, and one theater was talking about how they had never visited Shakespeare and they never do the classics, because doing a classic means that you cannot do a contemporary play. And I just went, huh. That to me is a most fundamental misunderstanding of what a play is. That because a play is to be performed live in front of a contemporary audience, it is always contemporary. You know, Thornton Wilder talked about the theater existing in the perpetual present tense. That we cannot really know exactly how the audience reacted to the original cast of Oedipus Rex. But we do know how we respond. And it's through the lens of our lives and the things that have happened to us. And I think if you're asking for the genius of Shakespeare, it's because the subtleties of his observations about people and the broad cross-section of humanity that he examines in his plays with seemingly intimate detail, which of course is simply manufactured from the magic of language and the theater. That is astounding, that it still resonates to us with so powerfully today, and that we still have the arguments about the slightest interpretations of, and I'm not even talking about interpretations of language, I'm talking about in terms of acting, how to play that line, how to react to what's just been said to me, because it is so potently real.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't have said it any better. We'll return to the Tony Chase interview and our discussion of Good in a few minutes, but first, here is the arts calendar for the next few weeks. The 1891 Opera House Cinema Series will have three movies in the coming weeks. All Cinema Series movies screen on Saturday and the following Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. Tickets for the Cinema Series are $7 for adults, $6.50 for members, and $5 for students, available at the door only on the night of the show. About My Father, a comedy featuring Sebastian Maniscalco and Robert De Niro, will screen on July 8th and 11th. You Hurt My Feelings, with Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Tobias Menzies, will screen July 22nd and 25th. And 32 Sounds, a documentary soundscape from filmmaker Sam Green, will be shown on July 29th and August 1st.
For more information on these movies, go to the Opera House website at www.fredopera.org and click on Cinema Series. Also coming to the Opera House this summer will be another in the Chautauqua County History Lecture Series. Rick Barham tells the story of Fredonian Arthur McKinstry's Civil War experience through the letters he wrote home. Dear Uncle, a Fredonia soldier's Civil War letters will be presented on Thursday, August 17th at 7 p.m. Admission is free. Donations gratefully accepted. Main Street Studios has a complete summer lineup beginning June 29th with its production of Frank Lesser's Love Letter to Broadway, Guys and Dolls. Also this summer will be productions of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, as well as Young Company productions of Beauty and the Beast and Cinderella. Four summer camp sessions are also scheduled for different age groups between July 10th and August 12th. Head over to mainstreetstudios.org/events for a complete list of shows and camps. The Great Blue Heron Music Festival returns after a three-year COVID hiatus from Friday, June 30th through Sunday, July 2nd. Featuring 32 bands over 3 days, this festival has been ongoing in Sherman, New York for 30 years. Complete information can be found at greatblueheron.com. The Chautauqua Institute is now open with its summer offerings of lectures, plays, concerts, operas, and art exhibitions. Complete information can be found on their website at www.chq.org. And finally, the Lakeshore Center for the Arts will present the one-woman show, Anne, the story of the legendary late governor of Texas, Anne Richards. Buffalo's Priscilla Young Anchors portrays Anne Richards in a script by Holland Taylor. Ms. Young Anchor received a 2023 Artie nomination for her performance. Anne will have three performances, Friday, July 21st at 7:30 p.m., and two performances on Saturday, July 22nd at 2 p.m. and again at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $20 and can be purchased at the door or online at lakeshorecenterforthearts.com. Please remember, if you have an arts event coming up and would like to get it mentioned on the arts calendar, send us an email to operahouse@fredopera.org or call the box office at 716-679-1891 with your information. Also, this summer would be a good time to think about becoming a member of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House for the upcoming 2023-24 season. The Opera House is supported through a responsible balance of earned income and contributed support. In addition to the satisfaction of supporting a worthy organization, there are several benefits of membership in the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. These benefits include member discounts on selected Opera House events, advance notice on shows and special events, invitations to special members-only gatherings, listing in the Fredonia Opera House Program Guide, voting privileges at the annual meeting, and a subscription to Backstage, the Opera House member newsletter. Benefits are available to all members regardless of membership level. You can become a member online at www.fredopera.org/support-us or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891 and making your membership donation. Thanks in advance for your support.
Work it out. If I got cancer, that would worry me. Or if they stuck me in one of those concentration camps, one of Himmler's perverts got at me, that worries me. If Anne stopped loving me and ran off with another man, that would worry me. There's a whole scale of things that could worry me. The Jews and their problems, yes, they're on it. But very far down, for Christ's sake. The thing is, I am fundamentally a happy person. I am a happy person. Absolutely.
This particularly sparse production of Good, featuring David Tennant with two other actors, Elliot Levy and Sharon Small, taking all the other roles, was hailed as a riveting triumph for both its performance by Tennant and its continued relevance in today's world. Tony Chase and I take up these issues in the second part of this interview. Let's move to the second play that we have, which is the play entitled Good. It's coming Saturday, July 29th. It'll be at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a matinee performance. And this is a play that I think raised a few eyebrows when it first opened in 1982, I believe. And the Royal Shakespeare Company was the one who commissioned it and produced it.
Now, this will be a treat for me because I have never seen Good before. It was a sensation right after I left college and would have had no money for travel or for the theater unless it was local. And it is this, Good is about a man living in Frankfurt, a good man, a liberally minded man, a professor of literature who gets swept up in the whole rise of Nazism. And so we are not looking at the aftermath of Nazism. We are looking at good people who got involved in it, which just statistics tell us had to have been a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That for a mass movement like that to have happened, that, you know, Hitler comes in and is elected with a minority, but not a small minority, as he comes in and consolidates power. But I've been aware of this play. And I am not really aware of its controversy. So I'm curious to hear you tell me. It is such a point of pride in Britain that this play emerged in the 1980s and that it's coming back now, a time when the world seems to be shifting precipitously away from democracy. And so they bring us this play now.
Well, I think that's when I was talking about its controversy, I think that's the one that's it, because it's an unusual time for it to be, you know, revived in the rise of fascism and anti-democratic tendencies around the world, around Europe, in the United States, and all over the place. And this play presents a singular message about how good people can just, you know, not pay any attention and all of a sudden find themselves mixed up with all kinds of different evils. I'm wondering if... you know, just from your own personal point of view or anything like that, you see the parallels that might be possible, you know, as we look at political events today around the world.
There's always a push and pull between the personal good and the public good. And I think that if you're forced to make a choice and you say, well, for my family, for me, what would be good? And you begin to make little bargains as you have to go. It's the nature of making public policy. And we're at a moment where our nation is divided, and we see it very clearly between, for example, urban priorities and rural priorities. That seems to be one of the big American divides right now. Cities that are highly populated and diverse, well, of course, inclusion becomes a value in the city, and the great needs of large populations, rural people see this with great suspicion. And look at something like guns, how they play out in a rural area. You know, to have firearms out in the country is a very different phenomenon from having them in large numbers in a heavily populated urban area. And so it seems you're using my money, you're impinging on my freedom, that all of public resources are being spent on you, and not seeing the other half of that equation at all. And then people begin to make public policy decisions based on the world seen through the lens of their own self-interest, or even sometimes not their self-interest, sometimes their fantasies of self, that you get told that, you know, by a very wealthy man that, you know, I'm going to generate wealth and share it all around, and I care about you. And the fact that this is economically not supportable, that this is historically not supportable, makes no difference. You vote against your own self-interest because you aspire to the myth of someone else's life. And in the theater, we certainly understand that. You identify with someone, not you. It's like, that's not going to happen for you. That no matter how many times people are told that trickle-down economics is a myth, there are people who buy into it. Well, these are people who are wealth creators. Yeah, and they keep it. No, they don't. You know, and they earned their own money. Yeah, and they used the roads you paid for and the schools you paid for and then just, you know, the public services we all pay for. And they use the labor of people who are being compensated a very, very, very small amount in exchange for the vast quantities of money being generated. Of course, that happens. And at moments when people feel left out, they are much more likely to gravitate toward the radical fringe and historically frequently the right wing.
You know, it's what's most interesting about this play, I think, is the very specific things that happen in the play compared to the very specific things that we see happening now. The play makes mention, for example, of the book burnings at the University of Berlin in 1933. Mm-hmm. The play makes specific reference of Kristallnacht, the Night of the Broken Glass, and we see more and more anti-Semitic actions taking place in the United States. The play specifically talks about the start of the Nazis' war against the Soviet Union in 1941, and we see now the Soviet Union at war against Ukraine, and there are probably good people in the Soviet Union who are, you know, against the war, but they won't say anything because of that particular fear. I have found, and you know, again, in looking at the play, that the specifics of what's in the play are hit a tone that's almost exactly the same tone as this play in terms of its historical context of pre-Nazi Germany.
Well, the playbook doesn't really need to change much. Number one, you attack the press, you know, and you light upon stigmatized people. That the rise in anti-Semitism we're seeing now, just appalling, but for me also just sort of astounding. I don't really comprehend. Yes, I see it historically. I read, I know it exists, but the nature of anti-Semitism, it just seems so arbitrary. I don't know, you know, what did Jews ever do to anybody? Just, you know, just seems so remote from my universe. And coming from the New York City area, I came from the Hudson Valley many years ago, but I'd never experienced anti-Semitism firsthand until I came to Buffalo. It was the first time I had ever heard people speak that way. You know, I'd seen it in plays, I'd seen it in movies, I'd seen Cabaret, I'd seen Gentleman's Agreement, but that this was a current and contemporary thing, and that someone would try to cause harm to people. The one that just is so very predictable right now is the backlash against transgender people. Mm-hmm. That's an old tried and true. You take a group of people for whom there's ick factor, and then you couple that to a disingenuous impulse to protect people and its children. You know, oh, we must protect children from this terrible evil, and we must protect children from having fairy tales read to them by drag queens at public libraries. And the most important issue pressing the nation today is who gets to use the toilet, and it's but people are very easily distracted by that, and it's so easy to get up on your high horse, and then most wonderful of wonderful, feel better than someone else, see someone else as being inferior to you. It's apparently one of the most pleasurable human experiences, feeling superior to someone else. And it totally taps into that. And maybe that's the Jewish thing. I don't know. It's just so bizarre. But the LGBTQ+ backlash right now, you know, Budweiser beer is for the first time in decades no longer the number one beer in America, because they sent a case of it to a transgender person. Huh. Wow. So we no longer like the taste of their beer. All right. It's and you know, clearly that's a lot of people not buying that beer. And you wonder how the Nazis happened. that it's I had participated. The Anne Frank Project is a social justice project out of Buffalo State University, and been going for many years. And in the very first year, I did a talk about fascism and conformity, and talking about, much like good, how do good people become a part of this? And a young man from the audience asked me, was I implying that this impulse to be repressive, this impulse to confine the rights of other people for reasons like that, was a movement toward fascism? And I said, no, I don't mean to imply that. I am stating that boldly. And he, as if to prove my point, went to the provost and tried to get me fired from my job. Oh. I thought, you do realize you're proving what I said to be true, right?
they never see that, Tony. They never see that.
No, yeah.
Never.
Okay. I can, you know, at least we see where, at least each of us sees where the other is coming from.
Yeah.
And okay.
Yes, but you know what worries me a little bit when I take a look at this particular play, Good, and I'll talk about David Tennant's performance in just a minute, but what particularly is that it's the lack of action. And just to continue out your example with the Bud Light beer, I am wondering why there just aren't a lot of people out there who find that particular fact appalling, just buying more Budweiser beer. You know, in other words, some kind of counterforce to put Budweiser beer back up as the number one.
It should be the only beer served at every gay bar in America right now. It should
exactly
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely be. Well, I can remember when the Florida Orange Juice Commission dropped Anita Bryant as the spokesperson, and it's when in the 1970s, late 70s, gay bars stopped serving screwdrivers, which was the most popular drink of the decade, and you know. Whoa, can't have that. Can't have it impinging on the sale of our product. But Target stores also pulled Pride merchandise, certain Pride merchandise, from their shelves. Mm-hmm. There is tremendous cowardice. It's the old Martin Luther King adage. No, it's not the words of our enemy, it's the silence of our friends that we will remember. Right.
Exactly. David Tennant apparently gives an astounding production in here. He's a kind of an interesting actor to me. All of the reviews talk about the fact that his portrayal of the lead character is so utterly like empty. Like you can really see almost the hole in the character where his conscience should be. I mean, it's that chilling.
The character, you know, keeping in mind, I've not seen everything I know of the play is from reading. John Holder is the name of the character.
John Holder,
and,
thank you.
Yes, and C.P. Taylor has endowed him with a kind of emotional detachment. This is part of the building of the character. To make a character real, that character has to have failings. And this character has a seemingly benign one, a certain amount of detachment, a tendency to get lost in music.
Yes.
To be able to let the world kind of roll over him in a way that from time to time we all do. Mm-hmm. In fact, we sometimes find people who get riled up about everything annoying. Mm-hmm. Why can't you just take it in stride? Well, you know, little by little by little, which is what C.P. Taylor affects in this play, little by little by little. And with just the right equation of personal secrets and vulnerabilities, we all have personality quirks that work as assets for us in certain situations and work against us in others. And that is one of the main ingredients of great playwriting.
But I think you're right there. I mean, I think you're so right. And I think that's what people are going to take away from the play. That's the most chilling in terms of this particular production, is just, if they haven't seen the play before, I think what they're going to take away is the idea that it's frighteningly easy to slip into this kind of situation where, you know, just so many things go by and so many things go by and so many things go by. And the next thing you know, you find yourself in a situation that a condition that was not of your making. But you're so detached from it, you don't even see the evil that you're supporting.
I mean, sure. It could even be more benign than that. You know, I have a personal quality. I just want people to get along.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes that is a lethal thing. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes that we like enough is enough. No, I cannot just let that pass. That we must stop and we must. There are times when that's not good enough. And I tend not to be confrontational. Sometimes confrontation is in order. And something that is an asset in one setting can be a flaw in another. I think that this playwright's given us something in a way that we can all identify and understand that, you know, he is too detached.
David Tennant, he seems to have a litany of being able to play evil characters quite well. So,
what do we conclude from that?
He's probably the nicest guy on the planet, and
he's probably on Earth.
Yeah, and he's probably one of the better actors you'll ever find. Well, listen, Tony, thank you so much. It's been an absolute honor to talk to you and have this discussion with you. You know,
well, an honor to talk. Honor. It's been a treat, hasn't it? I just love talking to someone who shares my obsessions. So,
so do I, actually. Yeah. You know, and it's really lots of fun to be able to sit and just, you know, talk theater as you do every Friday at 8:30 a.m. with your co-host Peter Hall on WBFO. That's Theater Talk with Anthony Chase. People should really listen to that because they'll get great insights into what's going on in the theater world in Buffalo, which is an amazing theater community.
It is.
I proudly say. I think that's the case. You can also check out his website, theatertalkbuffalo.com, where you can get samples of his writing. And it's interesting. I want to commend you, by the way. I've never got a chance to do this personally, but commend you for the articles you wrote on the situation at Shays Buffalo. I mean, talk about standing up for something and saying enough is enough and being confident. You did a magnificent job with that.
I appreciate that, Tom.
You really, really, just absolutely fantastic. And you're also going to be doing your cabaret performance for the third time by popular demand, I guess. It's called My Life in the Audience, 30 Years Watching Plays by Tony Chase, a 90-minute sort of a cabaret review show. Very interesting.
Yeah, I wish it were only 30 years. I saw my first play in 1964.
Sometimes I have more trouble being an audience member than I do being a cast member, and I have to learn to do better at that at some point in time. Okay, Tony, again, thank you so much. I hope we can do this again because this is really an enjoyable conversation. I had a great time.
Thank you. So did I.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Shakespeare's Othello will be screened on Saturday, July 8th at 1 p.m. and Good will be screened on Saturday, July 29th at 1 p.m. Tickets for either performance are $15 for adults and $10 for students, or you may use your Flex Pass. Tickets are available online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891.
I'll be alone each and every night. While you're away, don't forget to write. Bye-bye, so long, farewell. Bye-bye, so long. See you in September.
And that's it for this See You in September edition, as well as for Season 2 of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Mr. Brian Hoffman and Dr. Anthony Chase for being my guests on this episode. I'd also like to offer a special note of thanks to Opera House Executive Director Mr. Rick Davis, who has been so gracious in allowing me this wonderful opportunity to produce this podcast, as well as to Mr. Dan Allen, Opera House Technical Director and Designer of the podcast logo, and Ms. Marcia Finley, Box Office Manager, for their support and assistance in proof listening each episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is available wherever you get your podcasts, and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice, if possible, to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode, and the first one of Season 3, will be available on September 13th, 2023. I'm Tom Loplin, and until then, be safe out there, and be kind to one another.